Good morning, ladies. I'm frequently asked to come and speak on depression and make it funny. Yeah, that's not one of the easiest things to do in the world, but I've found out there's no point in being depressing about depression. We might as well take it with a light note and try to be funny about it if we possibly can. If you do have my book with you, Blow Away the Black Clouds, I will be going over some of the things in this, especially in the last chapter. If you do not have this, I would suggest strongly that you either buy it or borrow it from someone, because I feel that it's really a handbook for people who want to either counsel themselves or someone else in the area of depression. Yesterday someone asked me, what qualifications do you have to be speaking on overcoming depression and on counseling specifically? And I thought about it for a second, and then I had to really frankly say none. I really don't have academic qualifications to be teaching on this subject. But God chooses a lot of us who don't have a lot going for us in certain ways and gives us the ability to do what it is He wants us to do. And if we do believe that God has a plan for our lives and He wants to do something with us, then we have to believe that when He calls us to do something, He will give us the equipment and the background and the knowledge and the training to do this if we're open to His leading. When God chose Moses to go back into Egypt and to bring the people out, and He said, Moses, I want you to go back into Egypt, Moses was not thrilled with the assignment. And he'd been sitting for 40 years out in a pasture with some sheep. Now, he was happy with the sheep. And he didn't really want to get up and go do anything else. And when God called him and said, you're to go and to lead the people, Moses' answer was, don't choose me. Who am I to go? He said, because I have a slow tongue. Now, you can see how much smarter I am than Moses. Because of my slow tongue, he said, I could never go back there and do it. And so God said, I chose you to go, go and do it. When God chose Jeremiah, Jeremiah's answer was, you can't use me. Behold, I am a child. I've had no training, no academic background. When He chose Gideon, Gideon said, you can't use me. My entire family is poor in Manasseh, and I'm the worst of the lot. I don't have enough money to be useful. And God said, I chose you, go. Now see, when God decides He's going to use us for a certain reason, He gives us the experiences, and He gives us the knowledge, and gratefully the wisdom to be able to apply the experience in our lives to whatever situation He wants to use it. And I have found, as I have been counseling people in depressed states for probably 8 or 10 years, that the Lord wants two things out of us if we're going to counsel others. One is we have to have had some kind of an experience which gives us a compassion and a feeling for other people. I think that people who have been totally successful in everything they've touched in life cannot possibly have compassion for those who have fallen apart. And secondly, we need to have scriptural basis so that we know what we're talking about. Now, there are some people who are so full of experience, but they have an emotion, but they have no biblical background. There are some who are steeped in the Bible, but have never had a genuine experience in their lives. Now, what we need is the combination of both. And the Lord has touched my life in two ways. He's allowed me to go through experiences that have shown me what depression really is. He's given me a heart for women in trouble. And He's also forced me, disciplined me, into Bible study so that I know what the Word says and I'm hopefully not going to stray from it in counseling others. Now, those two things are very, very important if we are going to help other people. That we've had some kind of an experience, doesn't have to be the same one, but some kind of an experience that has given us, that has brought us to our knees at some point in our lives, where we've had to say, Lord, I can't do it. You're going to have to do it through me. And when we've gotten to that point, whatever the experience may be, then we do have a heart for other people with problems. Now, I never set out to speak on depression or to teach on it or to counsel depressed women. Frankly, left to my human nature, I don't even like gloomy women. I mean, I wouldn't talk to any of you if I was operating the flesh, because my goal in life is to surround myself with happy, bright, bubbly, witty, charming, articulate people just like me. Now, see, that's what I'd like to do in life. So therefore, I would avoid anybody who comes towards me with a tear in the eye or with a sad look. However, God didn't agree with me. And He decided somehow, and I don't know why, I thought it was a mistake for a while, but He decided to send me gloomy people. I mean, I cannot stand in a line at the supermarket without some lady pouring her heart out to me. If I go to the ladies' room, my husband knows he may not see me for hours. I inevitably find distraught women in the ladies' room of any restaurant anywhere. Ones who are standing there trying to make themselves beautiful, trying to patch up the tears, trying to get ready to go out and face whoever it is that they're with that they're really all upset with. Now see, I find sad women everywhere. Now that's not because I'm looking for them. I'm not. It's because God has chosen me, anointed me, to be available and open to encourage women with problems in life. Now when God chooses you for that kind of a role, you can't really buck it. I started about 8 or 10 years ago in my home teaching Bible study classes. And I'm grateful I have one of my pupils here today. Want to raise your hand, Martha? There's Martha right there. She took me out last night and paid for my dinner because she said that I'd given her a lot in the past. And I don't know if it was worth what she had to pay for me last night, but I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Martha was in my home for I don't know how long, but many, many months, maybe a year or so, that she came in my home to the Bible studies that I had there. Now, at that time, when I was teaching Bible studies, I did not look for a depression topic. In fact, at that point, I was trying to avoid even thinking about my sons. And when I first gave my testimony, I didn't even have them in it because I couldn't talk about it. I couldn't really, at that point, articulate the problems that I had been through. So I really didn't mention anything that was very depressing. I was teaching a Bible study course in my home on Proverbs 31, and one of the lessons I taught was on joy. And I was telling women how, as Christians, that they must exhibit joy. People must see in them something joyful, something better. We Christian women are not supposed to be gloomy, sad, miserable, wretched, in little black dresses in corners. That's not what we're to be. We are to be so radiant and so open to the Lord that He's shining through us so that people do see a difference in us, so that people will come up to us and say, there's something different about you. Now, I feel when nobody says that to me for a few days, there's probably nothing much different about me those days, and I had better get back into tune. So as I was teaching these lessons on joy, one girl came up to me afterwards and she said, I loved your depression message. Now see, I didn't give a depression message. I didn't even want to think depressing thoughts. She said, I loved your depression message. Another girl came up and she said to me, if I gathered together all my depressed friends, would you come over and speak to them? Now that was my first inkling that the Lord was calling me to something I didn't want to do. And I said to her, well, if you could get them all together, I would come. Now, I knew, first place, she didn't have many depressed friends. This is 8 years ago, maybe 10 years ago. And I didn't know any that there was a lot of depression at that time. I know differently now. And so I thought, first place, she doesn't have a lot of depressed friends. Secondly, they won't come anyway. And thirdly, she's going to forget the whole thing. So I said, yes, I would do it. The next morning, she called me up. She says, I have 15 depressed friends coming over Friday afternoon. That was my first speaking on depression. And you see how many of you here today are interested in it. But at that time, 15 depressed women in a room, and they were depressed women. I walked in there, I thought, Lord, why? I mean, I'd like to spend a cheery afternoon, and I've got this sad group. Well, it's grown. A few months ago, I spoke at the convention of the National Suiciders Anonymous. Now, you're laughing. This was not a funny group. I mean, I walked in there, and I had a marvelous opening line. You see, each one there, to even belong to that group, had to have tried to kill themselves and not made it. I mean, they had to have, or they wouldn't have been there, see. So I opened it up, and I thought, I'll be really witty here. And I started off, I said, I've never spoken to an audience before, whereby their mere presence in the seats shows you're all failures. Now, I mean, I thought that was an interesting opening line. Didn't even go over too well with you, but it sure didn't go over with them. I mean, there was not even a smile over that line. Because to them, this wasn't funny. Now, I quickly shifted gears, and I didn't try anything funny for the rest of that day because I realized they were hurting to the point of killing themselves tonight, and they didn't need to be too funny about it. Now, see, depression is not really a funny subject. We can use light examples, and when they're about someone else, they might be funny. But when are they not funny? When it's you that's sitting there with the problem on your heart. And so we have to learn that while we can be lighthearted about many things, that we can't be flip with someone. We can't try to be cute with someone who's thinking of killing themselves tonight. Now, in order to do any kind of counseling on depression, you've got to know something. And as I share in the last chapter here, and if you've got it with you, I'd like you to turn to the last chapter, How to Counsel a Depressed Person. And we're going to go over some of the points that I have in there. I'll find your page in a minute. How to live with a... Let me tell you one interesting thing. When I wrote this book, I wrote everything but the last two chapters. I had worked with depressed people for a long time. I had been teaching this as a course, and so I sat down, I wrote all the things in here that came right from my head and from my heart, and I put the book together. Now, any of you that have ever authored anything know that if you ever finish up a book, you are so glad to get it off to the printer and get it out of your hands. You don't even want to think about it again. And so when I finished this, I sat down with the whole manuscript, and the manuscript is much bigger than it looks at the end, and I sat down with all these papers, and I prayed, and I said, God, show me if this book is correct, if this is what people need to know. And if it is not, and I've left out something key, then please show me what I should put in there. Now, when I prayed that not wanting an answer. Now, usually we pray for answers, see? I prayed out of obedience to the Lord, that I knew I had to pray and ask him, is this the right thing to be sharing with people? But I prayed hoping he would say to me, it's just wonderful, leave it the way it is. But when I finished reading the whole thing, it was clear as a bell. I mean, it was just like the Lord wrote it out on the paper in front of me. He said, you have missed two things. You've not said how to live with a depressed person or how to counsel a depressed person. And I kind of rejected that. I said, Lord, that doesn't need to be in here. And he said, yes, it does. You prayed, and that's it. Put it in there. So I sat down. I wrote how to live with a depressed person one day, and I wrote how to counsel a depressed person the next day. I had a girl type it up right the way it was without even reading it again, and I sent it right off without even proofreading the pages. I sent it right off because I was already due to have the manuscript in. So those two chapters I answered and wrote and sent off. I got a call from the editor a couple weeks later, and he said, the whole book is wonderful, but he said, I just want to tell you that the last two chapters are inspired. He said, they're really great, they're different from the rest, and he said, I didn't even have to change a comma. Now, it's interesting, when the Lord tells you to do something and you're faithful to what he has you do, it comes out better than when you're working in your own flesh. And so these last two chapters are the two that I've gotten the most comments on. The last chapter specifically is the thing that I've had more people talk to me about than any other part of the whole book. Now, the book in general gives you many different things that you should know. And if you look at the last chapter, the first point that I have made in here, chapter 11, How to Counsel a Depressed Person, page 107, the first point in here is to know your subject. None of us should start counseling people until we know something. God does not want us counseling out of ignorance. He wants us to know what kind of subject matter we're talking about. We don't need great academic degrees. In fact, one lady told me, that a friend who had heard me speak, she said, the best thing about your teaching is that you're unencumbered by theological training. Now, you think about that for a while. She said, you're unencumbered by theological training. You're not deep enough to be confusing. I wasn't quite sure how to take it at the time, but as I thought about it, I thought that's true. We don't need to be deep. I've heard a lot of deep speakers who are way over everybody's heads. And you can listen to wonderful people, and you can be impressed with their intelligence and their vocabulary and with where they've been and what they know. And you can be overwhelmed by it at the time. But if you get home the next day and you can't remember a thing they said, and it didn't make any sense to you and it didn't change your life, then what difference did it make how intelligent they are? All that matters is that you know the experience that you are dealing with. So the first thing in counseling a depressed person is to know what the subject is all about. Now, here in this book, I have gone over things such as the definition of depression. I've given many definitions. The simplest way is to say that depression is a feeling of hopelessness. There's no hope. There's no way out. I'm not going to make it. Or helplessness. I can't take care of this myself. I can't help myself out of this. There's nothing more humanly that I can do about it. Now, when we're in that kind of a position, whether it's true or not, when we're in that kind of a position mentally that there's no hope for this whole situation, then we are usually depressed, because the word depressed itself, the actual word depressed, means pushed down, held down. And many times when you wake up in the morning, you realize that your spirits are held down. They are depressed. They are underneath. You don't have much bounce to you. You are being held down or depressed. If you depress something, you put your thumb on it, you press down on it, and that is a depression. And so this is the way many of us are. We are in a depression. So you have to understand, first place, what a depression is. Now, when I'm talking about counseling depressed people, everybody with a problem is depressed. So when you're talking about depression, you may be talking about marriage problems, children problems, business problems, any kind of problems. Because when you are in a situation of a problem, you are depressed. Your spirits are down, no matter what the circumstances of the problem may be. So almost anyone you're counseling with a problem is depressed. So we can start right there. You are going to be counseling depressed people if they have problems. Now, we look in here at the definition of depression. I also give you a list in there of all the symptoms of depression. And again, we don't have time to go over all of those today, but I would suggest strongly to you that you read over in here the symptoms of depression, and they go in increasing severity. And as you look at those, you will be able to spot in yourself and in others when someone is going down the road to depression. You'll be able to spot it in teenagers. My 17-year-old adopted son this year has gone to two funerals of friends from nice families in the area where we live, teenagers who have killed themselves, who have committed suicide. The ultimate result of untreated depression is suicide. That's the ultimate result. Now, we hope we don't get there. We hope that we catch ourselves or other people before that point. But it is the ultimate result of untreated depression. As you look at the symptoms in here, you will see things such as passiveness, loss of interest, pessimism, and hopelessness. Those are some of the first ones. People don't usually notice those in the beginning. They go down to areas where people are changing their eating habits, where they are either eating too much or eating too little, where they are starving themselves to death or they're getting obese over their depression. Some depressed people eat to cheer themselves up. And when they eat a lot to cheer themselves up, what happens to them? They gain more weight. When they gain more weight, what's that do to them? They get more depressed. They get more depressed. They want to cheer themselves up by eating. I went out with one friend one morning, and she had been telling me about her weight problem and how much this disturbed her, and she was going to have to someday do something about it, and she was depressed over her weight. We went out for breakfast together. She ordered waffles with extra butter and extra syrup, and she poured it all over the thing. And when she saw me looking at it, she said to me, "I feel I deserve a waffle." Now, I thought about it. What does one do in life to deserve a waffle? I mean, there's no big award in life that says that. She deserves a waffle. Now, you see, what is she doing? What is the waffle to her? It's cheering her up. Statistics show in this country that over half of all the drugs sold over the counter in the pharmacies today are mood-elevating drugs. Over half. We're not fighting germs. What are we fighting? We are fighting gloom in our heads, depression. I haven't got it my way. It's not turning out the way I wanted. I expected life to be this way. It hasn't gotten that way. My husband is over here with someone else. My children don't appreciate me, whatever it is. And we think, if we take something for this, what's that going to do to us? What do we think it's going to do to us? We think it's going to relieve the problem. What does taking any kind of drugs ultimately do to us? It at most postpones facing the problem. But when we sober up, or when we get out from under the drug, whatever it is, where is the problem? It's not only still sitting there, but what's happened to it while we were off in our euphoria? It got worse. So you see, that's never the answer. So as we look at this, we see these various symptoms, the overeating, the undereating, increase in drinking and drugs, not being able to sleep or sleeping all the time, either way. Some people who are depressed can't sleep at all. They go to bed and their eyes are wide open. Some people at the same stage in depression sleep all the time. They wake up in the morning, they say, "Oh dear, one more miserable day." Back to sleep they go, pull up the covers and stay there. One woman told me she sleeps every single day, Monday through Friday. Now I asked her, "Why don't you sleep Saturday and Sunday?" And she said, "Well, because my husband's home, then he makes me get up." Now, see, she's so depressed all week, she just counts it loss. She just goes to bed. When she goes to bed Sunday night, she knows she's not going to appear until Saturday. And that's the way her life goes. She's that depressed. Now, I talk with women at all different stages of depression. But if you understand at least the symptoms and the stages that they go through in increasing severity, you'll be able to spot some of these things before it's too late. Towards the end of the symptoms is one symptom called sudden improvement. And this one I want to specifically mention to you, even though there isn't time to do all of these, but I specifically want to mention this because many people spot this as a good sign instead of what it is, the end. And this is when a person has been depressed for a long time. Let me give you an example. A girlfriend of mine had been the college beauty queen. She married the most likely to succeed captain of the football team. He went out and played professional football for a while and finally had to get down to work and get a job. And so he stopped playing football and life became real. He didn't like real life. He only liked play life. She had been the queen of the beauties, and here all of a sudden she had five children. She was a little chubby. She didn't look so good anymore. She was depressed. All right, so we had a depressed man over here because he had to go to work instead of play football. We had a depressed beauty queen over here who wasn't a beauty anymore and had five little kids that she couldn't stand, didn't want any of them. And so here we got a couple of depressed people. Now, one day I went over to her house, and this is long before I knew anything about depression. It's just that since then, the Lord has brought these things to my mind. I went over to her house one day, and she acted all happy. The kids didn't seem to bother her at all. She seemed to be floating above everything. I came home and told my husband. I said, "Mary's really gotten over it. She's okay. She seems to be fine now. I guess she's gotten out of her depression." And I didn't even probably use the term depression, because in those days, we didn't use that term. I didn't know what was wrong with her, but at least I said she's better. The next day she went to a doctor's office. It was in his home. She went into his kitchen. She took out a butcher knife, went out in front of all the people in the sitting room, and stabbed herself in the heart. Now, she hit a bone. She didn't kill herself, but it was a terrible mess. They carted her off to the mental hospital, and while she was off there, I found out, the doctor told her, that it was when she appeared to get better that she had decided to kill herself. Now, you see, the people who have no hope and there's no way out and they're depressed, ultimately, they begin to plan, how can I get out of this? When they figure out how to, then they become, for a period of time, it may be a day, it may be a week, it may be a month, but during the time, from the time they made the decision, how they're going to end it, and have gotten the equipment, whatever it may be, ready, then there is a sudden improvement. Now, what you have to be aware of in someone you're watching in a depressed state like this is when that comes, this is not a time, usually, that it's over and they're fine and they've just instantly recovered. It means that the end is near. Now, when you understand that, it will help you a little bit in dealing with a depressed person to be able to understand that and know that. I had one lady told me that the woman next door had been very depressed after her husband died, and one night she called all of her married children together for a dinner party. And they said, oh, isn't this wonderful? Mother seems to have picked up and gotten over this problem. And so she had them all for dinner. She was in a gown. She had crystal out, candlesticks, everything just perfect. And after they left, they said, Mother is over the depression. The next morning, she was dead. She had killed herself. She had staged her own farewell party. And she was cheerful and pleasant for the first time because she knew she wasn't going to have to stand one more day of depression. It was going to be over. So many times people plan this, and when they have planned it, then there is a little happiness, a little lift for a period of time. I was in Phoenix, I speak a lot in Phoenix, and I was in Phoenix in Goldwater's department store one day in the shoe department, and this lady came up to me. She said, aren't you Florence Littauer? And I said, yes. And she said, well, I recognized your voice when you were talking with someone over here, and she hadn't seen me really, but she'd heard me. And of course, my husband says, one doesn't need to see me to hear me. And so she came over to me to talk to me, and she said, I just want to tell you that if it weren't for you, I wouldn't be standing here today. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, last year you spoke at the Arizona Women's Retreat. She said, at that point, I was extremely depressed. She said, I didn't even know about the Arizona Women's Retreat, but the lady next door who had been being nice to me, she said, I didn't recognize at the time what she had that I didn't have, but she'd been nice to me. And she came over that day, and she said, are you doing anything this weekend? And she said, I already told her I didn't want to go to that retreat. But she came over and said, are you busy? And I said, well, really, I'm not. And she said, well, then come with me to the Arizona Women's Retreat. Somebody couldn't go, and she said, I it's going to be paid for you. Now, this was a very wealthy lady. She didn't need her way paid. But it's amazing how when someone says, there's a free ticket. Now, I don't even know if there was a free ticket. But you see, she said there was a free ticket. We don't want to waste it. Wouldn't you come? So the lady pulled herself together and she went. And she said, I got there. And she said, you started speaking on depression. And she said, when you went down the list of symptoms, she said, I could see every one of them in my life. Every one of them right down the line. And she says, as I went through those things, she said, I realized that the only reason I was sitting there was because I was at the stage of sudden improvement, because I had already planned and bought the sleeping pills to kill myself with Sunday night, and I was just going to wait out the weekend and be done with it. She said, when you got to the end of that, and after you'd gone through the symptoms, after I'd recognized my problem in my life, she said, at the end, you told some of your testimony, and you told the problems you'd been through, she said, which made mine look like nothing. And she said, then you asked at the end for those of us who were depressed to pray with you and to ask the Lord to come into their lives and to change them and to give them joy. And she said, I prayed with you at the end of that. And she said, by the time I got home and looked at the sleeping pills, she said, I didn't want to do it anymore. She said, I threw them away, and it's been uphill ever since. Now, see, that's only one of women. I have no idea how many women have been touched because of my lesson, because of my life. You know, David said in Psalm 51, after he had been through the problem with Bathsheba and after God had chastised him about it, he cried out in Psalm 51 and he said, when I'm through with all this, when this is all over, when I've gotten to the other side of it, he said, I am going to go out and share my testimony. He said, I am going to tell transgressors about what you can do for me. And he said, I'm going to have many sinners converted because of my testimony and story. Now, see, God allows us to go through some things. I don't think he sits around trying to punish us. But he allows us to go through things in order that he may perfect us, in order that we may go out and tell transgressors our story to encourage them, in order that many sinners will be converted. Now, see, David said that, and that's what God's done with my story. I don't tell my story socially. When anyone asks me in a social situation how many children I have, I say three and leave it at that. I don't bother saying I've given birth to four, lost two, adopted one, ended up with three. That's the real answer. But why should I go through that? I don't want anybody's pity. I don't want anybody to say, oh, you poor dear thing. I only use my testimony when it can be of help to other people, when they can see that if you can live through that and if you can get above it, then there's hope for me. You see, that's what God uses our problems with. And David said, I will go out and bring transgressors to you, and many sinners will be converted through the fact that I've been a sinner, that I've been in trouble, that I've done wrong things. But through that, God, you're going to bring something good out of it. And that's why he uses my testimony in the way he does, because you can see there is hope. I spoke the day that my son died. And as I finished my testimony that night, I shared with them, I just got the news before I spoke to you tonight that my son just died. Now, you can say, well, you couldn't get too upset over that. You haven't seen him in a while, and you weren't in contact anyway. But it is your flesh and blood. And when they're gone, they're gone. And there's just a feeling about it, no matter how removed you might have been about it, it's over. And there's a finality to death. You see, when I can share that, people know if you can be here, and if you can be positive, and if you can have a sense of humor through these things, then God is real, and He can do something with me. I didn't share in the other group because I haven't shared this basically publicly. But this year, my daughter Lauren, I have one little grandson who's three, my daughter Lauren was expecting, and she had a miscarriage, a very difficult miscarriage at 5.5 months, and the autopsy showed that the child was severely brain damaged. This was a really difficult trauma for us, and we just faced this fall. So in this fall, I've had that problem where I've had to uplift my daughter when it was grieving me deeply inside. And this also was a girl, which blew our theory that only boys could have this problem in our family. And so we have really had a traumatic experience in that, and then losing my son in February. So this has been a heavy year. But God is faithful, and He will give me the ability to get through it because He has a plan for my life, and He wants to use me with people like you. And so I share these truths with you today for that reason. Now, when you're counseling anybody who's depressed, whether it's yourself or someone else, you first place have to know something. And you should read everything you could possibly read on the subject of depression. Don't get too heavily into many of the secular things because you will get somewhat confused. Many secular counselors today are giving very bad advice and are telling you, I've had women come to me, try to pick them up after their problems, where somebody has told them the problem with you is that you are frigid. And this is a situation that's been caused because your husband hasn't been nice to you. And what you need to do is go out and get some loose experiences with someone else that will help to free you from what's inhibiting within you. Now, I've talked to women who have already done that under someone's instruction. Now, anytime, if you know anything about the Bible at all, and any counselor gives you any information or suggestions that are contrary to God's word, then you know they're wrong. And nowhere, when God is consistent throughout the Bible and says a husband and a wife must be faithful to one another, when the Bible says that, if a counselor tells you go out and do something different, what does your mind have to tell you? That if it's opposite to God's word, doesn't matter what degree this person has got or how learned he is or what kind of a big suite of offices he's got and what cute nurses he's got standing around. If he's telling you anything contrary to God's word, get out. Don't listen to it. Now, the reason that we need to have some counselors like you available is that there are more and more and more and more depressed women today than there ever have been before. Husbands are running away right and left. Children are taking off on all kinds of scenes everywhere you turn. Christian leaders are divorcing their wives and going off and marrying some cute young thing. All kinds of things in the Christian world are falling apart today. And we need somebody with a level head that can counsel. Now, I don't mean that you should set up a shop and put a shingle out. I haven't done that. I don't say I'm a counselor. I never try to be one. I don't even look for cases. And you shouldn't either. Why do you need to know about depression? Not for the ones you're going to look for, but what? For the ones who are looking for you. For the poor, sad soul that can't find a person to talk to. The one who's depressed. And that's when you have to be available and open. So let's look at some of the things in here on how to counsel a depressed person. First place is to know something. And start out by reading this book. Read anything you can on it. My other book, The Pursuit of Happiness, is my life story that also deals more closely than this with my personal problems. It deals with my life, the humorous part of it, and it brings it up to date within the last 2 years. And I've already updated you on the only two significant things that have happened to me this year in the area of real problems. And so the one is on my life story, and this one is a text that I feel everybody that's going to counsel on depression should have in their hands. There are other books. I have a whole list of them in the back. Many things for you to read. But I think that the difference between mine and others is, as I said before, that I'm simple. I put it down where anybody can understand it and can work with it. And I feel that many times, I picked up one book recently on depression that's basically selling very well as a depression book, and it's very, very thick. And I started reading that. Now, I've spent 10 years now studying depression, and I couldn't make head and tails out of that book. Now, I figure if I, who's steeped in this, can't figure out what in the world this man is trying to say, then what is anyone else going to do with it? So I know there are lots of books out there. Lots of them are deeper than mine, and they're bigger than mine, and they're loftier than mine. But mine's simple enough for anyone to understand and to put into practical use right tomorrow. I've had some women that have come to me and said right after I've talked with them on depression that they went home, someone called them, they opened up the book, this chapter on how to counsel a depressed person, and they went through the different steps with the person on the phone and were able to bring the person into a better shape. So you see, it is possible to do this. So let's look at some of the points that are in here. First place, know your subject. I've already suggested that, and that's very important. Secondly, beware of friends. Now, this is really a problem because, you see, to counsel anybody, And the Lord has given me a boldness that I didn't used to have. I used to try to couch all my expressions nicely because I wanted so much to be popular and to be liked by people. So I never said anything that would hurt them, and I always said nice, kind things. The Lord has stripped me of that in counseling. Now, I don't mean I run around trying to be rude. We should never do that. We don't want to hurt anyone. But he has given me a boldness to cut through to the truth and to forget the trivia. And when you counsel a friend, you do them no good if you're not honest. But if you're honest, you will probably lose the friend. So consequently, it is better for you not to counsel a friend with whom you need social relationships. I once had one friend who came to me, and every time she came to me socially, she would be telling about her marriage problems. Finally, I said to her, do you want me to be your counselor or your friend? Because I don't think I can be both. Now, God inspired me to say that because at the time I didn't have any wisdom on it. And she said, well, I'd rather be your friend. I said, fine, then go get a counselor. And we sent her to a counselor, and she went to a counselor. And when she came to me, I said, don't talk about your marriage problems. I want to be your friend, but not your counselor. And I said, it's very hard to mix the two. In fact, ultimately, if you do mix the two, you ultimately will either do the person damage by not telling them really truthfully what their problem is, or you will have them be disinterested in you, and you will lose them as a friend. So it's important that you realize this. Don't try to counsel close friends. Send them to someone else. Now, you can commiserate with them, you can be sorry for them, and you can listen to them. But don't try to counsel them or to straighten them out, because in order to straighten someone out, you've got to get to the heart of the problem, and you've got to get to the heart of the problem quickly. Now, the third thing is to establish desire in them. And now, this is extremely important. I mentioned a little bit about this yesterday by giving you some examples of people who weren't willing to be helped. I found out, and again, I've gotten bold on this, I feel God inspired, that when I sit down with a person and she starts to tell me her story, I say to her, do you really want help from me today, or do you just want me to listen? Now, that there usually is quite a pause after that question. And they sit there and they think about it because they haven't really gotten it down to that. Some people are professional counsel seekers. Every Christian speaker that passes through town, they come and dump their entire life on them. They don't want one bit of advice. They wouldn't change if you gave them the greatest ideas in the world. They only want you to constantly pity them and feel sorry for them. Now, I have learned to ferret those out, and I don't waste any time on them. Now, it's not that I'm heartless at all. It's that I feel the Lord has given me a ministry, and I have got to put my time in the best possible place. So when I ask a girl, even if someone comes into my office in California, if they come in and sit down, I start right off. Now, you've come here today. I know you have a problem. Now, if I could come up with a solution for this problem, and it meant that you had to do something, would you be willing to change? Now, see, that really takes some time of reflection. The longer it takes, the less apt they are to be open to any suggestions. Now, sometimes they will say, well, of course I want help or I wouldn't have come to you. And I say, well, then in that case, are you willing to take some action? And when I get about there, they'll say, well, the problem really isn't me. The problem is with my husband. Or the problem is with this person or that person or this situation. If only I had more money, I could be happy. If only it weren't for this, I'd be all right. Now, the minute they get into that, I say, well, I can't give you money. I can't cure your alcoholic husband. I can't bring back this one who's running around with the lady down the street. I can't do any of those things at all. So let's start right off by realizing I cannot change your situation. Now, that depresses them a little worse. But it's the truth. I cannot change the situation. I can't heal babies. I can't do any of these things. So I say, what we can do is we can only work with you because you're the one that came. Now, see, that's important to realize. You are the one that came. We cannot change your husband. We cannot change your children. We cannot change anybody else. But what can we really do? We can begin to find out what part of you is offensive to the Lord and begin to straighten it out. I had one woman say to me, well, what if I did all the things you tell me and I became a good wife? This was a woman who needed to lose weight, needed to cheer up, needed to know something. She was ignorant about anything in life, hadn't even read a book in years. She didn't even know what was going on in the world. And so when I talked to her and said, I said, would you be willing to shape up these things? And she said, well, what if I did all those improvements and my husband didn't come back anyway? Now, see, that seemed to be a big question to her at the moment. And I said, well, you'd be in better shape at least. Now, see, I can't guarantee I can bring back her husband, but we can get her straightened out so that if he never comes back, at least she's in better mental and physical condition to face whatever she's going to have to face in life. Now, see, we have to work with the person that came. And that's the only person that we can do anything about, is to work with that person. And so we have to initially, right off in the beginning, establish desire. We have to find out what it is that is wrong with them and what we're going to do about it. All right, so we have to establish desire. The next point, over here, is to examine the past, the present, and the future. Now, those three words are the important key to counseling. The past, the present, the future. And I hang all of my counseling on that. If you look at the page where it has a depression questionnaire in there, right here, depression questionnaire, This will give you a guideline to go over when you are counseling a depressed person. First place, and I use these myself. I have them mimeographed off like this, so I keep them in my desk and my notebook, and I go over this. What's the apparent problem? What's the real problem? What's the background of the person? What's all of their symptoms? And then in the counseling, I go into the past, the present, and the future. Now, most secular counselors spend most of their time on the past. I had one lady who wanted to pour out her past, and you don't need to listen to too much past. All you need to do for the past is to bring it up to today. You just need enough information about their past to know where you're standing today. That's all you need, is just a little of the past. And this one lady said to me, well, the last counselor I went to, and she'd already established she'd paid him $60 an hour, she said, the last counselor I went to, he was happy to listen to my past. She was telling me, she was disturbed with me, I didn't want to listen too much. And I said, if you were paying me $60 an hour, I would be happy to listen to your past too. But I said, since I'm counseling you for free, I have to do it quickly. So let's get right down to the heart of the problem. I've heard enough of the past. So basically, if you think of those three words in your counseling, the past, the present, the future, you realize that the past, you only need to hear enough to bring it up to today. And that may only take 5 or 10 minutes. You don't need to listen through the entire bitter experience. If he hit her once, you don't need to hear a description of all of them. Once we'll do it. So as soon as you get through with the past, then you move up into the present. Now, when you get to the present, you've got the problem before you, you know what's happened, and then you say to them, all right, what are the alternatives you can do about this problem? Now, I always start with asking them what alternatives there are for solution. Now, every person that I ask that to, what are the alternatives? They always say there aren't any. I say, oh, yes, there's alternatives to everything. All right, well, the husband's run off here, and I'm depressed because he's run off with somebody else. All right, what are the alternatives? Well, one alternative, I ask them, you know, what could you do about it? I could kill myself. Wonderful, very good alternative. I write it down. And when they see me writing down, kill myself, that really kind of shakes them. I write down, very good, that is an alternative. We'll write it down here. I have right down here, list alternatives. So I sit there, I'm filling this out as I'm talking to them, and I say, kill yourself. Very good, that's the first alternative, kill yourself. And then I don't blanch at that, and I say, right, what's another alternative? And they kind of look at me because they think I'm going to deal with that one. I said, no, are there any other choices? Well, I could run away. Right, you could run away. Run away. All right, run away. All right, that's very good. So we've got two now. You kill yourself, you can run away. All right, you could badger him and try to get him back. So many women make this terrible mistake. He's over here, he's got something else going for him, and she's some cute little thing who is devoting her entire life in slavery to him, looking up at him like God himself, complimenting him day and night, doing all the things for him that you haven't done in years. See, and you got that for competition. So how happy is he going to be when you badger him? One lady told me she climbed up the fire escape of the other woman, put tacks, carpet tacks in the bed. Now, do you think that that man turned down the bed with this gorgeous thing in a negligee beside him, and he turned down the bed and he looked in there and says, carpet tacks? That must mean my wife wants me back. Goodbye, honey. Now, is that the reaction he's going to have? It's not going to bring him back. I've had women who has put detectives on his tail, things like that, you see. When you do this kind of thing, all you do is throw him away. You might as well not waste your time and your money and your effort of putting in the tax, or one went to the girl's apartment and took all of her vitamins and flushed them down the toilet, she told me. I mean, it did give the girl a little less energy for a couple of days, but other than that, it didn't really change the problem at all, you see. So here it is, this kind of a situation. You can't do anything about it. So you ask them, all right, what are the alternatives? Badger him to death and try to get him back. That is an alternative. And I give them some of these suggestions. I say, well, you could try this one. One lady did this, the tax. One lady did the pills here. There's lots of different things. I'm very creative. I can give you a lot of ideas if you wish to continue badgering him. So that's one thing, badger him. Very good. All right, now we've got three. What's the fourth one you could do? Accept the situation. I have to help them with this one. They never come up with this alone. Accept that this is where I'm sitting today and that God's going to bring something good out of it if I shape up and do what I'm supposed to do and forget him, forget her, forget everything, and start working where? On me. Now, see, all of us have a great complex of wanting to straighten out everybody else in life. How many of you right now can think of some person that you really could straighten out this afternoon if they'd only listen? How many of you say, okay. See, we're all junior psychiatrists anyway, except we're working from wrong knowledge and we're heading in the wrong direction. So we have to know how to do it. All right, so then you say, what are the alternatives? Here they are. All right, kill yourself, run away, badger him, or shape up. All right, now that's the order they usually come out in. All right, so then we say, all right, the next thing is, after we're listing the alternatives here, now we're going to list the probable consequences of doing this. All right, you can kill yourself. That's alternative number one. I always talk about that brightly. I make it sound like a really good alternative because you find out if you go over and say, oh, don't kill yourself. Oh, that's a terrible thought. Oh, don't do that. You know, then what does it do in the depressed person? It's the cheeriest thought they've had. Somebody is really paying attention to their suicide attempt. And that makes it kind of interesting, and they're going to see how far they can go with it. So what I do is say, fine, kill yourself. Very good. All right, now let's look at the consequences of killing yourself. Now, what are the consequences? And I make them tell me back. What are the consequences? Well, it's all over. I'm through with this whole terrible mess and this rotten world and every awful person that hates me and all the people have done me in, and it's over. I say, very good, it is. You are now with the Lord. Because I'm almost always dealing with Christian people. See, they've got some knowledge of the scripture, but it didn't do them a lot of good. So I say, all right, that's good. You are through. You're with the Lord. That's wonderful. Now, I don't do this unless I already know they have some children. But if as soon as we decide, okay, they're off with the Lord, they're on a pink cloud, everything's wonderful with you. And then I say to them, how old are your children? 2, 4, and 6. Oh, adorable ages. They must be really cute. Yes, they are. They are wonderful children. Show me pictures of it. They are really cute. Who's going to take care of them? Well, this gets a real pause. What do you mean? Well, I mean, you're not going to kill them too and take them with you. So, I mean, once you're gone, who's going to take care of these children? Well, I don't know. And then I always suggest their mother-in-law. I say, how about your mother-in-law? She'd probably love to bring them up. That'd be a good idea. Let's figure out where to place the children. I mention that, and they scream. I will not let my mother-in-law bring my child. I said, then maybe you better not kill yourself. I guess I better not. All right, then we cross out alternative one. I put a big line right through it. See, now right now I've eliminated suicide because she already told me she's not going to decide. I put a line right, big black line through it. We're crossing out alternative one. Second alternative, run away. All right, now when you run away, do you have any place to go? Well, no, but I'll find a place. Do you have any skills, any job? Well, I don't really know. I guess I could be a waitress in a truck stop. I suggest that to them. And that seems to be one of the worst things to suggest. So I say, well, you know, you're going to probably just hitchhike across the country or something, so maybe end up in a truck stop. You'd be a waitress. At one point, my husband ran a truck stop, and so I give him a few of the choice experiences I had running a truck stop. And so that gets them a little dissuaded from that. And so then I say, are you going to take the children with you? Well, I don't really know. Well, if you leave them home, you got the same problem again. You're going to leave them with your mother-in-law? Well, then we cross out possibility two. All right, then we get into badger him, and I go over that. I said, now, badgering is interesting, and it may be even creative fun for a while, but I can tell you from experience in my own life that I have never found any man yet who came back because he was badgered, because he got notes and letters and was besieged and had people on his tail and had all kinds of threats and things like this. And in fact, I recently read the book Men in Midlife Crisis. For those of you who are midlife like me with a crisis, you had better read that. And it tells you about men. And the pastor who wrote that, he said, I have never seen one man return home because he was badgered into it or because he was told by someone that he was a sinner. Now, a man who's out playing around on the side, who's also a Christian, does not get reached easily by someone telling him, do you know that you're a sinner? If you were really into the Word, you wouldn't be doing this, because he's already wrestled through that and decided this is worth it. So he's already gone beyond that, so you don't have to bring that up to him. He already knows he's a sinner, he's thought it over, and he's decided if you had to live with her, you'd run off with this one too. He's already worked that over, so that's no surprise to him that he's a sinner. He already knows that, but he's enjoying it. And some of us Christians think that sin is ugly and unattractive, but most sin today comes attractively packaged better than we. And so consequently, sin is not a negative. Sin appears to be a positive. So we're not going to approach him with any of those things. So you can't read him scripture. You can't yell at him. You can't send him threatening letters. You can't have the detectives running after him. Any of these things are not really going to work. And so we got to cross out badgering him. All right, so ultimately we get down to the last possibility, which is I had better do what God wants to do in my life, regardless of whether he ever shapes up. Now, see, God holds you and me accountable for our actions, not for his reactions. Now, that's an important thing to remember. And most women don't have that clearly in their heads. Some people will say, well, I tried it once and it didn't work. God didn't ask you whether it was going to work. He said, do what you're supposed to do. Be the kind of wife you should. Learn what you should learn. Do what you should do. And don't worry about his reactions. He's my problem. Some men come back, some men don't come back. Nobody can promise you. You can't go to any counsel in the world and have them promise you that if you do 1, 2, 3, he's going to come running back tomorrow. There's no promise there. Now, I'm just using infidelity as one example. Any kind of thing can work here. All right, so you go through the present. Here's the alternatives. Here are the consequences. Then I say to them, now that you have given me, I always keep telling the person I'm counseling that they have done the work. Never should you say, I am making this decision for you. Now, there are certain things you can make decisions on as a counselor. Sometimes I talk with women, and when I ask them, I see a woman who's kind of sloppy here. She doesn't look too well put together. And I say to her things like, what'd you eat today before you came? And now, if it's that much pause, I know she didn't eat anything. Or if she ate it, it's something she's ashamed to tell me, like Coke and potato chips and a candy bar on the way over. And so I find out that a lot of them haven't eaten anything right, and they're eating all the wrong things, and their health is terrible, and they don't look good, and they don't feel good, and they haven't got any pep, and their husbands are so bored to tears with them that they can hardly wait to get out of the house. So I check out their health by asking a few little key questions like that. Then I ask them, did you do the dishes before you came this morning? Now, if they hesitate 1 second to answer me, I know they didn't, even though they will look at me and lie and say they did. But if they hesitate 1 minute, that means they're deciding whether or not to lie to me. And so a hesitation is, I did not do the dishes this morning. So I don't have to, I let them lie, and I don't tell them they're lying, but I know in my head they are. And so then I know they have a messy house. I say to them, are you a messy housekeeper? Well, I don't really think I am, but my husband sometimes says I am. I had one woman I talked to recently, she brought me a depressed friend. She was fine. She's the great Christian savior, this woman. And she brought me this poor little case she had. And I sat at lunch with them, and she tells me about the case. The case was really in pretty good shape after I talked to her. She really knew what she was doing. But the savior here was in a mess. And so the savior said to me something about, well, she, my friend here, one of the things she does well is she's a good housekeeper. So I looked at her, I said, how are you as a housekeeper? And there was this real big pause. Now see, when you are asking the questions, you see, you are at a great advantage because you know in your head what question you're going to ask. So you are ready to watch the response. They don't know what question you're going to ask, so they are therefore responders. Now, do you understand? So you can judge a lot by the pauses and the looks because you know what you're going to ask. And after a while, you ask certain questions and you can tell right off from the answers what the situation is. So I said to her, how's your housework? She said, well, I don't really like housework. Now, I've had a lot of women, a lot of Christian women think it's demeaning to do housework. I happen to like housework. I really do. I love fixing everything up. And I have trouble getting myself out of the house in the morning to go down to my office, and I try to keep them separate or I'd never get anything done at the office at all because I'd be playing around with the laundries all day and watering the plants. So I have to force myself to get out of there. But so when I said to her about the housework, she said, I don't like to do housework. And I said, what do you do with your time? Because she'd already said she didn't work. I said, what do you do with your time? She said, well, I spend most of my day and evenings on the phone counseling women with marriage problems. I said, that is wonderful. That is very good that you are available to do this. And I said, how does your husband like you doing this counseling? She said, well, he doesn't like it a lot at night when he's home. And I said, how often do you do it at night? She said, almost till midnight every night. I said, do you go to bed when your husband does? No, I don't, because I'm so busy helping these women. Has your husband mentioned anything about the housekeeping? Big pause. Well, yes. I said, what did he say? It's amazing how women cannot understand what a man says. They can't understand simple statements. I said, what did he say? She said to me, now this is the truth, this lady told me. She looked at me and she said, he told me last week that if I didn't clean this house, he was going to leave me. And I said, how did that affect you? She said, well, he would never do that. And I said, but he told you he would do that. Yes, he did tell me that. And I said, do you think that your husband, does he just make idle statements like this all the time? No, he's never mentioned it before. But he did say last week that if you did not clean the house, he was going to leave you. Right, he said that. So then I looked at the girlfriend, the poor mixed up one, and I said to her, I said, is that clear to you? She said, oh yes, I got it. I said, it was clear to me too. I said, there's only one of us here who didn't seem to get that message. And she was the one that heard it. Now you see, he told her that clearly. And what had she done? Nothing. Because she's spiritual. She doesn't need to clean a house. She's on the phone all day helping women who've got marriage problems. Now, what's wrong with her life? She is going to have no testimony at all when next week he walks out. What's she going to tell the ladies on the phone then? Actually, I know what she's going to do then. She then becomes the distraught wife who is abused, who was walked out on when she was good, noble, wonderful, and spending all her time on the phone counseling people. She will get the entire church to rise to her side, because I've seen this happen so many times. She will become the great virtuous wife with the terrible, bad, philandering husband here who may have had nobody in mind at all when he walked out the door, but doesn't take him long to find someone. 4 o'clock in a bar, and they're all set. So here he's gone. All right, and now she's the noble one, and I've seen this happen. Then she starts counseling women whose husbands have left, and they all commiserate together. Now, see, she'll go on doing her little thing because she's convinced that that's what God wants her to do, plus the fact she loves gossip. Now, I want to tell you one thing. If you're going to counsel anybody in a Christian way, you better wipe out of your mind right now that this is gossip. You better wipe out of your mind that one story they ever tell you should go anywhere else. Because I have seen Christian women who set themselves up, not with shingles out front, but set themselves up mentally as counselors. And everything that comes in goes out. I had a pastor in my neighborhood that I knew very, very well. I knew him as a personal friend. He had a secretary that I knew well. One of my very good friends went to him for counsel. Her daughter had been raped. She went in and she told the pastor the daughter had been raped. She said to him, don't you tell one person in this church what has happened. I don't want anyone to know. My daughter will be looked at as a freak. Don't let anyone know. But she wanted to ask him a few questions. He walked out of the office after my friend walked down. See, I didn't know anything about this with my friend. She walked out of the office. The pastor told his secretary, right off. He said, do you know that so-and-so's daughter has been raped and so forth? Told the secretary right off. Secretary was my friend, too. She called me up. Within 2 minutes of the time that this girl told the pastor, in confidence, never to tell anyone, I knew. The girl walked into my house a half hour later to tell me. I had a great difficulty in appearing shocked when I'd already heard the story. Now, see, this is totally wrong. He should never have told the secretary. She should never have told me. And the minute I sensed she was telling me, I should not have listened. I see, three of us were wrong. Now, when you are taking anyone's story into your confidence, you must, absolutely must, be sure that under no circumstances do you share one word of this with anybody. And if you are loose-tongued about it, don't counsel anybody at all. And this is really important. All right, we've looked now at the past a little bit, at the present, which is considering all our alternatives, looking at the consequences, and then saying to them, this is the decision you have made. Now, why is it very important that you tell them, this is the decision that you have made? There's two reasons. One, they need to have made a decision. And most depressed people can't make any decision. They are emotionally about on a third grade level. They have to be treated like a child. You have to pull everything out of them. You have to lift them up. You have to wind them up and send them out. So they can't make decisions. So it's important for you to say, you have now made a decision. You're going to shape yourself out. The second reason is that later, if they do what you conclude incorrectly and poorly, you want to make sure that you are not to blame for what happens. So I always repeat several times, you have now made this decision. This is what you're going to do. All right, now that brings us up to the present. Now then I always give them an assignment, some kind of an assignment. Now I have some women that are sitting there that are sloppy housekeepers, and I've already established this and I know that, and I say to them something about cleaning their whole house. Now when you say, again, you always start with the biggest and the worst. I say to them, could you go home this afternoon and clean your entire house? Oh, they almost fall off the chair at the thought of it. Oh no, it's in too big a mess for that. I could never clean the whole house in one day. Could you do a room? No, I don't think I could do a room. Think you could handle a drawer? Now, most of them, no matter how depressed they are, they usually think they can handle a drawer. Now, when someone is in a mental hospital, they have them take little courses like basket weaving and little wallets. My friend that stabbed herself in the heart, she used to bring me home when she came home for weekends. She'd bring me home a little wallet 1 week. She brought me home little earrings. At the time, I didn't understand the significance of this. And I thought to myself, what am I going to do with these tacky little earrings, little glued-on things? And what am I going to do with them? But you know what I didn't realize then that I realize now is the reason in the mental hospitals they're having them gluing little earrings together and making little wallets is because a depressed person has to accomplish something. No goals equal no accomplishment equals depression. So they have to be able to accomplish something. So therefore, I looked later at the more significance of these little wallets. This wallet isn't just a little wallet. This is what? The first thing she's accomplished that she set out to do in a long time. She has achieved a goal. A simple little goal for me, but for her, a major encouragement because she did something. So I say to them, all right, let's start with a drawer. Now, these are people who haven't accomplished anything. And I found out cleaning a drawer, it's amazing what that can do to lift someone. And so I say, all right, now you go home and clean a drawer. I've had people say to me, how do you clean a drawer? Now, you laugh, but you see, somebody who's really depressed cannot figure out how to clean a drawer. So I say to them, all right, this is what you do. And I can't believe some of the counseling I do, sitting around doing things that you'd think was such trivia. But we have to start somewhere where someone can do something and get something accomplished, something going. And if the husband is left because the place is a mess, or if he's left because she's too heavy, then I start putting her on diets. If it's a messy house, I start with the drawers. Whatever it is, we give them a significant human achievement to make in the next week. And I say, all right, you go home. And what you do is you put a lot of newspaper down on the floor, and you take the drawer out, and you dump it upside down. And some of them just cringe at the thought of that because they picture some terrible drawer that's full of all kinds of gum wrappers and string. And they don't know what they're going to do if they dump that all out. So I say, you dump it all out on the piece of paper. And then you have on one side of you, you have a wastebasket, a large wastebasket. The other side of you, you have a box. And you label that box, things too good to throw away but not good enough to use. You label it that. Now, you sit down there with all these things, see? And what's left over, you put back in the drawer. All right, so most of it goes right in the trash. Some of it goes into that box, but that makes them think a little bit. If it's not good enough to use, why am I saving it? Now, some of you could evaluate half your house that way and get rid of it. I've had women call me up within an hour of the time they left my office, joyful, I mean joyful, and say, I've cleaned a drawer. Now, again, if you're not depressed, you think that's funny. But if you're depressed, you know, there's some of you here haven't even done that much in a long time. And then I say, do you think you can handle two? Try another one. Then I show them how to do the closet. Take every single piece of clothing you've got in that closet out. Take it out. Put it on the bed. Vacuum out the closet. You're going to find a few earrings in the corner you've been missing for years. You're going to find a lot of stuff. You take everything off the shelves. You empty it all out into the room. Now, I start with a child's room first, because otherwise they get too depressed if it's their own. They can't get to bed that night. And so you show them how to do this. Say, you look at all the clothing, and you find out, do not save clothes that are different sizes that you are going to reduce into. How many of you have got stuff in your closet that you're going to reduce into? In the closet. All right, now, if you're going to save it, if they're marvelous, marvelous designer outfits that you spent a fortune on, then what should you do with them? Put them in a box and label them. Put them in the garage. Size 12, probably never again. Put it up on the shelf. Put it in there. Get rid of it. Get it out of there. All right? Now, do you get the hang of what we're going to do for an assignment? Now, some of them, if their problem is only spiritual and they haven't got any human things that are problems with them, but it's just all in their heads, which sometimes it is, then you develop a spiritual program for them that they must do between now and the next time they come back. But the thing is that when they leave you, whether it's your house or where it is that you are, you give them an assignment that you will not see them again until they've done it. Now, this weeds out all the people that don't want any help from those who do want help. Because the ones who don't want any help and have been running around getting counsel from other people who have just listened to their miseries for years, those people who want to just go out and find counselors forever and ever and don't want to improve, they will never come back because they see you mean business and you're going to make them do something. And they don't want to do anything, so they're not going to come back. So you see, instead of you insulting them and saying, I don't want to talk with you or waste my time with you, you give them the assignment and then they don't ever come back again. And that gets rid of them. They'll go talk to somebody else who won't make them do anything. Now, those of them who are serious will come back. All right, now that will give you a way of weeding out some people. All right, then into the future, because I see our time is up, the future area. Now, any human secular counselor can counsel the past, because all you need to counsel the past is what? Ears. That's all you need to counsel someone on their past. You only need to listen. You don't need to be bright. You don't even have to be tuned in. I'm sure half the psychiatrists sitting around with the people telling them their troubles aren't even listening, because I know from experience, after you've heard the first 5 minutes, you heard it all. You don't need to hear the whole dreary life. You've got a picture of it. So probably half of them aren't even listening. It's a pretty easy job if you can get away with it. And so anybody can counsel the past. A lot of human counselors can take care of the present right now, go home and clean the house, or what else. But it takes a Christian counselor to handle the future. And most secular counselors go no further than today. We're only going to get through one more week. And many times that's all we can get through is one more week. But the counselor's got to have in their mind that there is a future. And only the Lord Jesus Christ, functioning in our lives, is going to be able to change our future. And so we have to show them that you've done this in the past, you're sitting here in the present, but if you want any change in your life, you've got to change your faulty behavior patterns that have given you this past and that are hovering over you in the present, and we've got to eliminate them in the future, and only through the power of the Lord Jesus can that be done. And that's what you have to share with someone. And that's where the Christian aspect of it has to enter in. So I have down there in the future on the chart that to analyze faulty behavior patterns, to plan future corrections, and to establish needed goals. I also have an area there where you check their health problems, because you will find some women who aren't eating correctly, who are taking too many tranquilizers. Somebody came up to me the other day right after the message, and she said, that was really fine, but I do have a headache, and I'm going to go take these pills, your little handful of pills. And I said, well, I guess that's because I didn't give the message on drugs today. And she was heading off to take her little pills. Now, it may be one of you, and I'm sure she said, well, it's only for a headache. And I know it's only for a headache. But you know what happens to people who take a lot of pills for headaches? Pretty soon they need stronger pills for headaches. When they need stronger pills for headaches, then what do they need because they're so depressed over it? What do they need? Something to cheer them up. So they take something to cheer them up. After they take that for a while, they can't get to sleep at night, so they need what? Something to put them to sleep. They get up in the morning, what do they need? Something to pep them up. It's amazing how just a little habit of putting in a few pills here and there can lead into a drug problem that most of us fine Christian women would never say we had. Then I have down here the assignment that I give them and some suggested help. Now, this will give you just a few basic techniques of what to do. So I suggest to you read everything you can on depression, everything that you possibly can, on any kind of problems. Remember always that you're counseling a little bit of the past, a lot of the present until you get them moving, and then you are helping them into the future. You're giving them specific assignments. You're showing them how to help themselves out of the problem. You're letting them, when they take the alternatives, you're letting them list the alternatives. You are helping them to see the consequences of each one of these alternatives, and then you are helping them make a decision, which is a very hard thing for them to do, and then you are telling them, you are making this decision. Go on and do it in the name of the Lord Jesus. Now, when you are able to counsel in this way, you will find that God will use you no matter what your academic training is, no matter what it is. If you've had an experience to give you compassion and are standing on the Word to give you instruction and wisdom, God will use you mightily to help depressed women, and there are so many today. May the Lord use you well.